This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. You couldn't have planned it this way. Exactly 10 years to the day since the last time John Rowland was sentenced to prison, he'll be sentenced again today in a New Haven courtroom. Meanwhile, it seems our current governor is fighting a wave of unpopularity as state elections officials investigate the way Democrats spent money to get him reelected. Those are just a few of the stories that we'll take a look at in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, which is back this week after a few weeks on hiatus. You can join our conversation 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining me, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. It's good to see you once again, Kalila.
Good to be back.
And here for what we're calling Bill Curry Day is Bill Curry. He's a columnist for Salon.com, our political analyst. It's the first of two appearances on our air today. We'll be talking about the other one coming up in just a little bit. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Great to be here, John. Thank you.
We're going to be previewing a conversation we're having tomorrow with the chairman from Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods Resort Casino. They're going to be talking about plans to build new casino gambling sites in Connecticut to compete with other states. Back in 2012, Foxwoods chairman Rodney Butler joined us on the program, and we talked about things like increased competition from places like Massachusetts. Here's what he said.
Now, interestingly, when Mohegan first went up, the market grew. You know, there was capacity, excess capacity in the market. It grew, and we're both enjoying that success. But as gaming establishments open up in Rhode Island and Massachusetts and New York, the market isn't growing anymore. And so that affects both of us. And we just have to adjust to that new environment.
Adjusting to that new environment means seemingly working with some state lawmakers who think it's a really good idea to open up at least one, maybe several new gambling ventures in the state. The first one would be built somewhere between Hartford and Springfield to try to capture those north swimming gamblers heading up to the new casino in Springfield. What do you think of this plan, Colin?
Well, as I compared it in a column to building more typewriter factories, I mean, the fact is that casino gambling is on the decline. It's on the decline for a lot of different reasons. Not all of those reasons have to do with geographical competition. In other words, the decline in the betting handle at casinos started before there was this kind of neighborly competition going. So, you know, I don't know. I first of all think it's a bad idea. I think it's going to result in some shoddily constructed casinos thrown up as quickly as possible to get in Steve Wynn's way. And I also, you know, I'm going to just take a slightly longer detour. I'll make it faster.
That's fine.
I saw this movie last night. I was at Trinity. I saw this movie. It's called 2 Days and One Night. It's a French movie with Marion Cotillard. It's about this woman asking for her job. Basically, her coworkers have been told that they either if she gets to keep her job, they have to give up their bonus. And so one by one, she has to visit like 16 of her coworkers and just talk to them about why she should keep her job. And I just realized, you know, so often these kinds of stories, and it's this really heartrending thing, and it really there's a lot of humanity in this movie, but it reminded me of like how we think about jobs these days too. You know, that jobs are somebody's job is at the expense of somebody else's job, and we're always thrown into these pits like pit bulls, you know, to fight for our jobs. And I kind of resent the rhetoric around jobs here at this time. I don't think this is really about jobs or about preserving jobs. This is about the two big casino companies, let's call them what they are, trying to preserve as much of their revenue as they possibly can with the assistance of the state of Connecticut.
With the idea that this handle is, as Colin said, declining over the years substantially, Kalila, gambling, it seems, is not the business it once was. We heard in the introduction to our program a Bob Duff, a state lawmaker, saying Massachusetts has declared economic war on us, so we're going to fight back with more casinos. Is this the way to fight?
I don't think so, not in any long-term sustainable way. So the language sounds great, right? The rhetoric gets people riled up. But this isn't about jobs. This is really about ego and trying to claim ownership over an industry that is on the decline. We're not just competing with Massachusetts. We're competing with online gaming and online gambling in a way that throwing up two casinos does not address, whether these jobs will be here 5 years from now. And we've seen massive layoffs at other casinos. Why should this be any different?
Bill?
I would say, first of all, if we're going to go to war with another state, I'd start with Rhode Island. You know, and I just this whole idea that we're going to go to war with Massachusetts or that they've declared war on us, it's a little bit obviously over the top but kind of entertaining. I just want to underscore one thing here, and that is that how this relates to all kinds of issues like it. whether it was the baseball stadium, the convention center. For openers, always get these rosy reports of extraordinary economic advantages that never materialize, that have never been well documented, ever. And for openers, as with the baseball stadium, they tell you all the jobs it's going to bring to Hartford, but not the jobs it's going to cost New Britain. Talk about one of those cases where life really is a zero-sum game to some degree. They tell you people are going to be driving from hundreds of miles away in order to watch a minor league baseball game and stay overnight and go to dinner. And none of it's going to happen. The convention center wasn't going to draw most of its business or a great deal of its business from other competing venues in the greater Hartford area. But of course it did. And it's as if everyone suspends not just their disbelief but their actual knowledge when these moments come. And so I look at this process. And again, you also have with the casinos, as with Keno, as with the baseball stadium, the executive branch, the governor says he doesn't have a position, and they don't really know much about it. The legislature doesn't really have a very transparent process anymore. So we're all just sitting there waiting to find out what's being done in secret with taxpayer money. I just think that this is I get the desperation that's moving the tribes, and I get the wishful thinking that's moving the legislators. But this just looks like – not only does it look like all these other deals, but it looks worse.
Well, just yesterday, Kevin Brown, chairman of the Mohegans, testified at the Capitol yesterday. Here's what he had to say.
Even though our tribes have a long history of fierce competition, and even though we are competitors in business today, this threat is serious. It creates a common ground for everyone in this room, Democrat and Republican, sovereign tribe to sovereign state, tribe to tribe, union to non-union. There's a common denominator, and it is the jobs that stand to be lost.
Something in there, Colin, I just want to comment on that seems to me be lost in this conversation just a little bit is that over the course of the last few decades, after these two casinos were established and these two tribes were ensconced as the gambling industry in the state of Connecticut, the state of Connecticut at all levels has fought this war, if we're talking about wars, against any other tribal outfit trying to get federal recognition, from the Scaticokes to the Golden Hill Pawgussets. And this goes beyond whether or not they could get a casino built in a little patch of rock in Kent, but it actually has to do with the very thing that Kevin Brown's talking about, whether or not they're a sovereign nation. Connecticut seemingly has said no tribes, no new tribes, no new tribal gaming for all these years, and now everyone's getting together to try to get more casinos for just these two tribes.
So that Kevin Brown rhetoric about brothers and tribalism, that's not working for you? you brought this up on Monday in a meeting, and as far as I know, you're the first person to really sort of talk about this, and I think it's a really important point that what you just heard here from Kevin Brown, this kind of boilerplate talk about tribe to tribe, well, some tribes are more equal than others. He's not really talking about, he's not talking about the Great Spirit. He's talking about these two particular tribes who, as you say, have been ensconced in this particular niche.
And it gets into this big federal issue, Kalila, too, that we've been talking about for years, about the role of the federal government in allowing tribes to essentially become their own sovereign nations. Everyone knows that in the background we're talking about big casino revenues, but for many people in this world, it is not about casino revenues. It really is about making sure that our nation is recognized by the U.S. government.
And being able to affirm the identity of your choosing as opposed to having the federal government decide how you should identify and how you should navigate this country. And I think, again, to listen to the language of that speech yesterday, while recognizing it's really about monopolizing federal recognition and trying to stave off any future competition from other tribes that may emerge. And I think we need to separate those two questions about federal recognition versus our concern about a new tribe coming and building a new casino.
And just lastly point out that when a casino goes bad, it's worse than when a typewriter factory goes bad. The elements that are drawn, the social issues, the criminal issues that are all raised, where they get their money to begin with, who's left still gambling in them at the bitter end. I've used this comparison before and with you, John, but it's Baltimore, where you can build the greatest the Inner Harbor and Camden Yards and the most wonderful entertainment destination, and then 6 years later you can still film The Wire there because nothing else has changed. And the overall social impact of these casinos has never been as advertised. It's always been worse than advertised. The downside of this development is substantial. I wonder if they'll be talking about that.
The one good thing, Bill, if there's more casinos available in the state, maybe your Vegas show, the thing that you've been trying to get off the ground for all these years, maybe you've got a new home for
it. You're going all Julia Pistol on me now. Is that what's going on here? Wow, this is like Colin. I got to
You have not seen his Frankie Valli.
Yeah,
I just want to say that.
If you this is Bill Curry Appreciation Day. This is how that works.
That's exactly what it is today. 1-800-860-275-7266 if you want to join us. Before we actually take a break, we're going to jump ahead to something else. Since you mentioned this before, Bill, one other big announcement happening today. The official name of the new Hartford baseball team will be announced at 3:30 today. We're going to find out which of the finalists it is. Again, the finalists, for those who've been following this contest, are now Hedgehogs, Praying Mantis, not the Praying Mantises, but Praying Mantis, the River Hogs, the Whirly Birds, or the Yard Goats. I'd like to just go and take a quick survey. I know what Colin has to say about all this, so I'll go to you first. Colin, of those five, which would you find least offensive? And then I'll let you make a play for the one that you really think should be the name.
Well, I probably would find River Hogs least offensive because there's at least some kind of, you know, tenuous connection to Hartford's old Hog River. I will say one of the educations that I got watching this, and I think you sort of understood this better than I did going in, is the degree to which, I mean, obviously, in all the ways that Bill suggests, these statements, these sops to civic pride that go on when something like this is happening are exactly that. They're sops to civic pride. They don't really have anything to do with civic pride. And so watching this process unfold, you suddenly realize that there's a logo design company in San Diego, and there's like some consultant down in mid-Pennsylvania, and they're having this conversation and throwing some stuff out there for us to chew on while they're sort of making their own decisions about what's a marketable logo. And what they really want, what the pot of gold is, the Montgomery Biscuits. Montgomery Biscuits, which is a great logo. It's a double-A team in Montgomery. But you'd buy a biscuit hat or T-shirt even if you never set foot in Montgomery because it's just kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
It'd be kind of cool to have a hat with a biscuit on it or something. And that's the pot of gold. It has nothing to do with the actual connection to the city. They have no interest in that whatsoever. And it took me a while to realize that even the most minimal allegiance to that notion was an illusion.
And again, your choice, something you've been pushing for is...
Yeah. It wasn't my idea. Somebody else came up with the idea of the Huckleberries, which I think is sort of a great name. You could do it a couple of different ways, too. It's obviously got the Twain part of it, but you can have Huckleberry pies at the concession stands and some kind of dancing Huckleberry and a very
You've got a nice color already for your uniforms. I'm still behind the Hartford Huckleberries. I think it's a great idea. Of these five choices, Bill...
Let me just say, look, you can't do the Hedgehogs because they're like always look like two outfielders colliding, when they're trying to catch the same
ball.
You
could do sort of the G Fox and the Hedgehogs.
Yeah, that whole Isaiah Berlin thing going on. Yeah, yeah, that's right. You could do the G Fox, Hedgehogs. And you can't do the Praying Mantis because that would scare the children. The huge mascot that makes all the children cry. I'd take the Whirly Birds if I thought that would mean that UTC wouldn't sell off Sikorsky. I'd be willing to make that deal tomorrow. It comes down to the River Hogs. I don't really know. I know what a Hog River is. I grew up next to it. I don't know what the River Hog exactly is. But I kind of agree. Yard Goats looks like you're going to have a losing season every year. So by process of elimination, despite the fact that the Huckleberries are clearly the best idea,
I'll
take that.
Okay. I was just going to say, if you see Catherine Smith from the DECD at the announcement today, you'll know something's up with the Whirly Birds. You'll know that somehow or other we've cut a deal with UTC. Kalila, what about you?
I'm stuck. I think River Hogs could give you a really great mascot, a really interesting mascot. But, I like Huckleberry Pie, too.
The reason I'm voting for the Yard Goats out of these five is because it's clearly the worst name. And it will be so widely ridiculed that it will draw attention to the fair capital city.
I do like the idea of some kind of Whirly Birds beer promotion. Yeah. If you really want to experience the Whirly Birds.
You could have a drone deliver your beer.
There we go. Yeah. The Whirly Birds. The drone will be our new mascot. Mm-hmm. I like this. I want to get to a couple of quick phone calls. John's in Meriden. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning. How you guys doing?
Good. What's up?
This is interesting because I'm sitting here thinking about all of the various gambling attempts that I've witnessed in my 60-something years. Back to the nonprofits that have to have church bingo and raffles to sustain themselves to do the good things that they do. And then I remember when OTB became a big deal. And we had this big thing in New Haven where you could go and watch OTB and bet. And then we had Hi-Li in, I think, three different places, and that kind of went belly up. Then we had a dog track in Bridgeport, which I don't know what happened to that.
Plainfield.
And we've got all of this high-stakes sports betting. You know, we regulate so much of this, kids can't have lemonade stands anymore because they're not paying taxes or whatever. You know, is all of this for entertainment? Are we feeding an addiction? You know, is this a tremendous waste of money? What's the cost-benefit analysis here for the consumer?
Well, and I think John raises one of the big questions that's always out there, Colin, about gambling. I mean, these are dollars that are being moved around the state. If we're keeping the gamblers in-state, not moving them to Massachusetts, what we're essentially doing is we're saying we are going to send our money that we have, no matter how we're getting it, into some sort of a hole in which the the casino will take 60% of it or more, no matter what.
Right. I mean, like, the money doesn't sort of stay in the state, you know, or in anything like the state, the way you might hope with certain kinds of economic enterprises. I mean, I will say this. Well, I want to say two things really quickly. One thing is, ironically, the first thing he mentioned, the nonprofit casino nights, that's the reason we have the
National Ducats. That's why we have gambling. Yes.
In other words, the Supreme Court decided if you had a permitted use in the state elsewhere, even for nonprofits, even for charities, then the tribes could do it. That's number one. Number two is, you know, whenever we talk about vice, I mean, we have to be honest. And the truth is, yes, there are a lot of alcoholics, and they wreck families, and they wreck their lives, and they crash into people's cars and kill them on the roads and stuff like that. But most of us still like to drink, you know? And a lot of people like to go to casinos and, you know, bet a little bit of money and have some fun. And, you know, I mean, they think that, I mean, I don't find it particularly fun, but there are people who do, and they enjoy it. And, I mean, we have to be a little bit honest about the fact that many of us, or people we know, or people we live with, or whatever, like to go to casinos, and they have a good time there. And so, I mean, it really isn't this dark, infernal pit. It's just not good public policy.
And that's really what it is. Is when you attach it directly, Kalila, to jobs and say, this is the only way we can keep jobs in the state. I have Clyde Barrow testifying yesterday saying we're going to lose $700 million. We're going to lose thousands and thousands of jobs. That scares people. But what Colin's saying is nothing wrong with gambling per se. It's about attaching it to this public policy.
Right. And it goes against so many of the other efforts that are happening in this state in terms of preparing students for the jobs of tomorrow, investing in that kind of sustainable development. And if you say the only way to do that is by building a casino, then why should I support all of these other legislative policies that have nothing to do with that as the job creation engine? And so I think we have to be consistent in the policy approach, but also understand why voters aren't that excited about this.
I want to get to Jeff in Prospect. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good, what's up?
I have a couple comments. One, the part about the casino that doesn't quite make much economic sense for Connecticut is that you're really not making anything, building anything, producing anything. You're really just shuffling money around. And then the second thing that I have a comment on is why, if many of these businesses, either the casinos or ballparks or any of those type of things, if they're really profitable profit winners, why does the state taxpayers have to fund millions of dollars up front for these things with joint ventures if they're really profitable? My thought is that they're really not as profitable as they talk about. There's not as significant a payback. And in some cases, like discussions about building certain centers in collaboration with private companies, we end up spending tens of millions of dollars either with tax incentives or straight up money for what turned out to be a handful of jobs. We could have just paid those people the money that we funded it, and they could have done fine.
Jeff, thank you very much for raising that. And there's a few different economic arguments in there. You know, when it comes to building ballparks, almost never in the history of American sports has a ballpark not been built with lots and lots of public money, and they do rarely put back into the public coffers what is promised. Just very quickly, Bill, a quick comment on the first thing he said. Really, all casino gambling is just shuffling money around. Well, we're pretty well ensconced in the financial services market here in Connecticut. We do an awful lot of work of just shuffling money around. I mean, people are employed that way.
It's like hedge funds for losers. You know, the idea of the casinos as part of the non-productive finance capital sector. I also just want to commend the first caller for reminding us of that litany of ghost towns, of the dog track and the high life fronton and the off-track betting parlor. You know, with a "this property is condemned" sign in front of all of them. And it's it should be a chilling reminder of the life cycle of a gambling interest.
Bill Curry is a columnist for Salon.com, our political analyst. Kalila Brown-Dean is associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. And Colin McEnroe is host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to consider 10 years after John Rowland got sentenced, it's time for him to get sentenced again. We'll also look at the popularity of politicians, including our current governor. You can join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's Wednesday, so it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're considering the news of the week with Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Bill Curry, who's a columnist for Salon.com and our political analyst, and also our own Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Very excited for your show this afternoon, Colin. Tell us what's on.
Well, every year at this time, we do a March Madness show. Bill is always on as an analyst with his nemesis, Julia Pastel. Also, a tradition for us is to have the president of Wofford College on. We will have the president of Wofford College on. Mike Pesca, host of The Gist with Mike Pesca, is going to join us for the entire show today. Usually he just kind of parachutes in really quickly. And then a new feature this year. You're probably getting pretty excited, Mr. Dankosky, for Friday night's Augustana versus Babson game, which is part of the Final Four of Division III basketball.
I put in a really, really big number with my bookie.
I put $10,000 down on that game.
Take those Babson Beavers. They beat Trinity. Actually, this year,
Trinity almost made it to the Final Four.
Division III this year, their bracket of 64 included Wesleyan, Trinity, Eastern Connecticut, and Albertus Magnus.
We're going to have squash, right?
Yeah, no, this is basketball.
Really?
And so we're going to have the coach of the Albertus Magnus men's team.
Oh, excellent.
Mitch Oliver.
Great.
So it's the March Madness special with Colin McEnroe this afternoon at 1 o'clock with Bill Curry on the program.
He's also in the food schmooze today, so he's going to get the full Ginsburg.
Absolutely. Very quickly, before we move too far from sports, we were talking about baseball. Patrick called in, he has a comment. He says that praying mantis, one of the names that is a possibility for the team, is a non-native species. He suggests something like the Hartford Puritan tiger beetles or some other cool native Connecticut bug.
It all frightened the children.
Children
screaming, fleeing the park.
And quickly, Colin, before we move too far from baseball, earlier this week you attended a public hearing on legislation stemming from a dispute that arose between former Major League player Doug Glanville and the West Hartford Police. Can you just explain exactly what this public hearing was about?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you remember, just to sketch it out really quickly, if you remember what happened, the West Hartford Police were looking for a guy who was going door-to-door offering to shovel snow, which turns out to be against a municipal ordinance in West Hartford. Couldn't find the guy on the east side of West Hartford, crossed over into the west end of Hartford. The cop was looking for an African-American guy with a shovel. He found one, a guy shoveling out a driveway in the west end. He asked the guy, hey, you trying to make some money shoveling snow? He turned out to be talking to a millionaire, former baseball player and ESPN sports analyst. So the answer was kind of no. And the encounter didn't go very well. I mean, it just wasn't really handled particularly well. And it's something that Doug has then sort of gone on to write about and think about. He said to me on Monday that it really has kind of consumed his thinking a lot over the last year. So the bill that's being considered might not seem to have too much to do with this. It addresses one tiny facet of that, and not so much the racial profiling as the question of whether police enforcing a municipal law ordinance. They're not in hot pursuit of a felon. They're not trying to catch some guy whose criminal act they've witnessed. They're just enforcing a municipal ordinance. Should they be able to cross city lines? He and his representative, Matt Ritter, think that that's already wrong. I think that they think that's already against state statutes. They want to make that more clear. And I asked Doug about it. He said basically, you know, when police encounter civilians, there's just a lot of things that can happen. A lot of things can go wrong. It could have been a teenage kid that he'd hired to shovel his driveway and who didn't answer responsibly, and that guy gets patted down and they find something. And, you know, I mean, we now, over the last year, we know these kinds of stories. So he's just sort of saying, you know, let's try to limit some of this contact that's not really necessary. The police probably couldn't have really even done anything with the illegal snow shoveling guy if they found him in Hartford anyway. So that's what that's about. And, you know, I mean, I salute this guy for, I mean, he just sort of stayed with us. He's really done his homework. I thought this was a bad idea for a bill at first. The more I talked to him, the more I thought, well, he's gotten very smart about this.
Well, and maybe not a good idea for a bill, bad idea for a bill, Kalila, not passing judgment on that, but I think Colin gets at one of the key points. It seems as though we're having a public hearing about this little municipal zoning ordinance town. We're not talking about the thing that we should be talking about once again, which is about why a cop would come up to a black man in this position versus probably a white homeowner in exactly the same position.
And I think I understand the sort of legislative interest in this, but I think the broader question is what we also need to address. You know, if he were not a former baseball player, not a millionaire, not have this connection continued, would his voice and his experience still matter in the same way? If he were a resident of Hartford who said, look, I'm just a homeowner here, would he still have that voice? Probably not. So how do you use this experience to address these broader issues to get something done satisfactorily in terms of policy, but to also say we all need to check our biases and how we interact because there is the potential for very negative, detrimental outcomes.
But there is something to what Colin was just saying, though, about any way in which we can limit the times and the ways in which police might have to have an unpleasant encounter with any individual. It maybe lessens the opportunity for some of the things that we've seen over the course of the last year that we don't want to see happen. On the flip side of it, of course, is the more police know the people in the neighborhood, the more they know the people in the neighborhood. And you don't really have to ask so many of those questions and have those confrontations because, well, you know who that is. That's Doug. He lives there.
Right. And that's sort of the idea behind community policing, of knowing the areas that you're in. I think limiting that kind of contact is important, but we also have to address what happens when the contact does occur. You can't limit everything. How do you change the dynamic once that contact does occur?
But, you know, just talking, one thing I realized is there's two sides, and they see this, what you might call the decision tree, differently. The cops see the decision tree as branching off into all these things, a lot of benign encounters, and maybe that one jackpot encounter where you wind up catching somebody who you really needed to catch. And so that's how they see the decision tree branching out. A lot of people of color in this country see the decision tree branching out a different way, maybe a few benign encounters, and then a whole bunch of different things that wind up with things going wrong. Or as you saw in the Ferguson report, they get a $50 citation, they miss a court date, you know, they wind up with a warrant out. I mean, that's how they see the decision tree. And so those are two very different visions of how it can branch out.
Bill?
Well, just Colin was talking about, that says you try to minimize the number of unpleasant encounters, and the other piece of it is that you try to minimize the unpleasantness of each encounter, and that is by training police. There is a problem here. The Ferguson report isn't just about Ferguson, and I was so disappointed watching the reaction to Blasio in New York from the police and how bitter that became and how quickly it became so bitter. And for someone to say there's a problem here of racial relations, there's a problem here of racial understanding, that immediately polarizes the community and sets off all so much of the police community not only on the defensive but on the offensive. Clearly, we've seen that there needs to be a lot more training, more transparency, more civilian accountability. We need all those things just to help the millions of good cops do a better job.
So 10 years ago today, former Governor John Rowland was sentenced to a year and a day in prison on corruption charges. When he was sentenced, our former Wheelhouse panelist Allison Lee Cowan wrote in the New York Times that the sentence drew gasps from some in the crowd. There was shock, though, that he didn't get sentenced for more time in prison by some. Today, right after our live show ends at 10 a.m., Rowland is scheduled to be sentenced again after being convicted on charges related to his role in the 2012 congressional campaign of Lisa Wilson Foley. We'll have coverage later on in the day. Colin, we've talked about this. We won't spend a ton of time on this, but given many of the appeals that he's made to try to get this thrown out and the judge essentially saying time and time again, no, this is going to happen and you are going to get sentenced. Do you have any expectation of leniency this time around?
No. I mean, I think Janet Arderton is sending a pretty clear signal that she's not dancing, you know. I mean, she's walking in a very straight line towards this day. And that has to be bad news for John Rowland. I mean, I would be astonished if he didn't get something approaching, you know, the maximum.
Kalila?
I agree. I think that we're going to see a maximum sentence here. It sends an important message to people who would engage in this type of behavior. And you cannot really justify being lenient toward him when we have such a tough-on-crime, zero-tolerance approach overall.
Bill?
You know, we've never recovered from the first round. Just weeks ago, you have the U.S. Attorney's Office announcing that we're going to get a special monitor office, a special task force, because our corruption has turned out to be so deeply rooted, so stubborn a thing. And the need to send out a clear signal to a state that has not taken care of its own ethics problems, that only relies upon the feds to prosecute all of these questions. You look at this Herbalife story this week. There are 100 stories around the country. Soft corruption, as Justice Kennedy termed it in Citizens United, has become the dominant culture of American politics. Everybody thinks that so long as there's not an explicit bribe involved, everything you do is okay. And so when you have a question like this where you've got a second-time offender who's the ringleader of the conspiracy, who's demonstrated no remorse, if the society can't stand up and set a clear line, then the trouble that it cost us, the money that it cost us, the disgrace of the democracy cost us, it just never ends.
Bill just mentioned this Herbalife investigation. This is an interesting story. And reading from Ed Mahoney's story in the Hartford Courant just the other day, a stock manipulation investigation captivating Wall Street spilled into Connecticut, where one of the state's premier lobbying firms is involved in a campaign to discredit Herbalife, the nutritional supplement giant at the center of the case. And this is a case, Colin, with an awful lot of threads. But again, coming home to roost right here in squarely in the middle of Connecticut's political power structure.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly where it's located. I just, on the face of it, reading Mahoney's story, it doesn't seem clear to me that Global Strategy is doing anything illegal. But it doesn't look good. And there may be other people who are doing things that are illegal. I mean, this is just to sort of sketch it out very quickly. So what we have here is a billionaire investor who has gone short. He has a short position on Herbalife. And in order to make that a successful endeavor, he's been running around trying to discredit them. And he's hired Global Strategy, a very powerful and influential lobbying group. Its most familiar name here in Connecticut is that of Roy Occhiogrosso, formerly the campaign manager and really chief advisor to Dan Malloy for a really long time. Roy, not involved in this particular thing. This involves Tanya Meck, another Global Strategy person who's worked also in the public sector, worked for Susan Bicewicz. She appears to have hired Chris Healy, a former state chairman and unindicted co-conspirator in the Roland story, who now has an $82,000 job as a spokesperson for the Republican side in the state legislature. But Chris Healy to go around and recruit people to disparage Herbalife among the people who have been involved in disparaging Herbalife for whatever reason, like writing letters to the attorney general, are Larry Deutsch, the city councilman in Hartford, Neil O'Leary, the former police chief and mayor of Waterbury. So, yeah. Power structure, center, that's where we are.
And Bill, what does all this say? I mean, nothing illegal going on here. This is just a story that illustrates exactly the way that power is wielded within the state to someone's very specific advantage.
Yes. And you know, and the Constitution forbids very few things, treason, impairing state. There are only three or four crimes that are mentioned. One of them is called the Bill of Attainder. And the principle of a bill of attainder is you can't make a law that just targets one individual or one company. It's right there, right up at the top. And this isn't the bill of attainder. They were looking for investigations. But it's absolutely in the spirit of that, where you're picking one company out and you're going after them, and you're going after them knowingly on behalf – in some cases knowingly, some cases not – on behalf of an entity that has an awful lot of money to make in the process. I agree with Colin. I don't think anyone did anything illegal here. I don't even think it's unusual. I think this is how our entire legislature operates in almost everything that it does. It doesn't pick out one company. Usually it's about the bill pertains to an industry, but it's always in the name of specific interest. Their ability to marshal all these political players and apply them to the task of making more money for private interests, this is the absolute archetype of our politics now, and someone's got to stand up and say no.
Well, one of the really interesting things, Kalila, about this Herbalife story, though, is, again, this billionaire William Ackman, who's bet against Herbalife, again, he's come under an awful lot of criticism. People say it's all about whether or not he can make this money. But what it's also done is, in many ways, discredited a lot of grassroots efforts amongst many people in the consumer protection movement, many people who run groups that are trying to look out for Latino consumers, because Herbalife has, in the way it constructs itself, sort of recruited an awful lot of people who don't have an awful lot of means, many from the Latino community, to be part of this. They've been saying all along some of the same things that Ackman and now his high-paid lobbying groups are saying, but their voices are kind of muddled in underneath all of this, and it's really lost in this entire political money struggle.
And I think that's what makes this so problematic, even if it is not illegal, even if it is not exceptional. But back to the story before of, you know, the fact that he has that voice and he has that audience and can bring in all the power players to promote that, it then discredits those who have been saying all along, this is why we should be concerned about this company.
Although I think Herbalife has some big names behind them, too. Doesn't
yeah, it's
Soros,
on both sides.
Yeah, it's on,
right.
on both sides.
So, I mean, there's money on both sides.
There is money on both sides.
And I do want to say, just so I'm not besmirching him, and finish your thought afterwards, but because I also know he's going to call here in 15 seconds. If Larry Deutsch wrote that letter, my guess is he probably wrote it for exactly the reasons that Kalila is talking about, because there's Latino constituents that who've had really bad experiences. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case with Neil O'Leary, too. Not everybody involved in this is doing it because they're being manipulated by power brokers.
And that's really what I'm talking about, yeah.
And I think there's a difference between speaking on behalf of a community and standing in solidarity with that community. And why now? The timing of it, the idea that there's money to be made on both sides. You know, no one's going broke over this. In many ways, it just helps them replicate that wealth to a larger extent. So, but I think for the public to talk about transparency, the public sees these kinds of stories and wonders, but wait a minute. You know, where is the real concern there for the consumer, or is it just about protecting your economic bottom line?
I mean, I just say, first of all, there are real questions about Herbalife and any one of these schemes, and it is in the nature of a pyramid scheme in many ways. It seems to be on its surface. I've begun to despair for the ability of my government to make factual determinations about complex issues and get to the bottom of these things. But the very idea that essentially somebody shorting a stock can commandeer the entire political culture to go to work setting up bills and letters and investigations, it is an outrage. It's just – I mean, people ought to really be angry about it.
Well, I wonder if Steve, who's calling in the car phone – Steve, are you angry about this or other things in politics?
I'm angry about those kinds of things, of course, because – It just seems like there's a lot of intellectual dishonesty among our politicians. We've been upset with Congress for not doing anything. I think at the root of it, there's, I guess, you know, one example I'm concerned about is that we should have a law that requires an audit of the state budget before every election, so that when these guys are running for re-election, they can't lie to us about whether or not there's a deficit again. I'm really turned off by the governor having said, I heard him on your programs, that we're all in balance, everything's hunky-dory. And then shortly after the election, he's discovered a gigantic hole. It's one thing to have a little rounding error. This is not a little bit of rounding error.
Well, and yeah, he very specifically told me that I didn't understand what the deficit was, Steve. But, you know, that's okay. I'm still learning. I'm learning all the time on the job. A quick comment on what Steve had to say, and thank you for your phone call. Bill?
You know, there's the news now, the Election Commission looking into the finances of this. Again, we set up Credit Jody Rowe, who actually forced down the throats of the leaders of my party in the legislature, a comprehensive campaign finance reform bill. And if you look at where we've gone in the last few years on campaign finance, ethics, and transparency, it's the wrong direction. It's the wrong direction. And as Roland heads off to be sentenced today, he had the previous record for raising money from people who do business with the state. And I would just look at this and Herbalife just look at all this together. My guess is that more people doing business with the state gave to this last campaign than to any campaign in history. That all previous records were shattered. This culture of soft corruption is coming close to owning this government. It's more powerful in Connecticut than it ever was. That's why this office has been set up, and that's why we need to do something.
And to flesh out what Bill was talking about, the State Elections Enforcement Commission has approved a request from investigators to issue subpoenas related to the development and distribution of campaign mailers supporting Governor Daniel Malloy's reelection last year. The question, Colin, has to do with whether the State Democratic Party illegally spent money on the mailers. This hasn't gone away.
No, I mean, if I were the state central committee, the state Democratic Central Committee, what I would do, I think the problem, they're going to have this problem over and over again, because basically it's like, you know, one of Jonah Hill's pool parties in Wolf of Wall Street there. It's a bunch of frat guys who are out of control, and there's sort of nobody, as far as I can tell, at state central or in the governor's office, and there's quite a permeable membrane between those two things right now. Mm-hmm. Nobody's really tapping the brake and saying, wait a second. They really need some, you know, Didn't Clinton talk about sort of the gray-haired guy, the Lloyd Cutler kind of guy? They need somebody who can sort of sit there and go, wait a minute, let's not do this. It's going to make us look bad. And there, I don't think there's that person does not exist in either of those locations right now.
Kalala?
And I think it's something that we'll continue to see, the influx of money in politics, the influx of people thinking I can kind of do what I want to do with this. And I think it's an issue for both political parties moving forward about being accountable, about being transparent, and making sure that these things are being done in the proper order.
And speaking of transparency, when we come back from our break, we'll have Bill Curry talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton's email scandal. We'll also continue with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University and our own Colin McEnroe. We will also consider something that lawmakers are taking a very close look at. What should be the state element? We're going to put that to you. Get some of your ideas. Email them, where we live at WNPR.org. You can tweet us, at where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll sit down with the chairman of both tribal casinos who say they're going to work together to build new gambling halls in the state to try to stave off the loss of jobs to Massachusetts. We'll talk with them, take some of your calls and questions tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Kalila Brown-Dean, who's associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, and Bill Curry, whose latest column for Salon.com really takes on the question of Hillary Clinton. And as we're talking, Bill, about Hillary Clinton's email follies, whether or not she should have had her emails on one server versus another, are we talking about the right things, asking the right questions about Hillary Clinton candidate in 2016?
Well, I think all the questions being asked are relevant. And some of them pertain to just how good is she at taking responsibility for her actions? How good is she at picking up on the tone of those about her? How ready is she this time to run? If there is no real primary, then if she has the same kinds of problems this time as last time, she'll be losing the general election, not the nomination, which for her supporters means a whole lot more. One of the things I've writing every time I write about her, I get an enormous amount of criticism from both sides and reaction from both sides. People who hate her, Peter, people who love her, but I do think that her supporters are doing her and the country a great disservice in the same way that Obama's supporters were so defensive in the first 2 years of his administration, first 4 years really, never wanting anyone to criticize. And all progressive discussion was shut down. And I don't think they did him any favors.
But can
and
I just
so
say
Hillary
something?
Hillary needs to get that kind of feedback now, especially if she's not going to have an opponent giving it to her in the primary.
But part of the problem, Kalila, is with both of these individuals, the criticism really isn't criticism about any of the things Bill wants them to be criticized for. It's always about who they are. Barack Obama was criticized for a lot of things that somebody who was a white politician wouldn't have been. Hillary Clinton is going to be criticized for a lot of things that a male politician wouldn't be. And that's just the reality of these two individuals.
And I think that's the elephant in the room, right? If people assuming that because she was a woman, she was not qualified to hold that office. And a lot of the critique of her really centered on gender as opposed to what she was actually doing. So we can critique whether that's appropriate for her to use the same email address and what that means for transparency and accountability. But we cannot do that absent the context of would we raise the same critiques. Barack Obama was criticized before he even did anything in office about associations and what will this mean? To whom will he be beholden once he comes into office? Politicians do enough that we can actually judge them on what they do as opposed to who they are.
There's two separate questions here, just one of which is, it is true the hateful critiques of the right have made it so hard to have a discussion about what either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton is doing right or wrong. Hillary's been taken out in an alley and rolled so many times by these really vicious thugs, as far as I'm concerned. I understand her bunker mentality. I understand the defense. We still have to have a discussion. And the right question about this was not so much to me about process or her personality. We have a problem in the secrecy of foreign policy. Whenever our foreign policy, national security establishment acts in secret, you get Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, you get Guatemala, you get Chile, you get hiring all these international criminals, all these terrible things that go on in private that don't make us proud. When we act in public, you get the Berlin Airlift and the Marshall Plan and the Peace Corps and the Alliance for Progress. The cure for American foreign policy is to take it public. I wish Hillary had gotten up and said, instead of saying we did unprecedented disclosure and everything was great, I wish I heard her say, we did everything according to the law and I always will. I want you to know that I hear that there are legitimate issues here and legitimate concerns and that I'll be looking at them and thinking about them and addressing them. She'd be better off, and I think we would too.
Colin?
Yeah, I just would quickly say this to me is a do rather than an are. If we're criticizing her about things that she is as opposed to things that she does, this is a does. You know, this is like, to me, like very weird and alarming behavior, having a server in your backyard. And I think it is a legitimate field of inquiry.
I think just quickly to Bill's point, though, one of the reasons why I feel as though her dogged supporters don't ask any of the tough questions is in part because they are fending off on her behalf some of the really vicious stuff that has come her way because she just is who she is. They don't help ask the tough questions because they need to put up the ramparts.
Yes, but so neither side's right. I mean, the vicious attacks from the right, the vast right-wing conspiracy, you know, that stinks. On the other hand, it's a reasonable response is not to minimize significant problems. This is a significant problem.
Speaking of things that are significant, well, this actually isn't something that's significant. The state legislative committee actually is talking about establishing a state element. And, you know, there are just so many options out there.
There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury and lithium and magnesium and dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum and plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium.
Yes, that's the element song from Tom Lehrer. Lawmakers who sponsored this bill, they say they want the state element to be, Colin, titanium? Is that the right state element, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, well, first of all, I don't care, and I think this is a, you know, an amusing diversion. I'm not going to pound my fist and say it's an enormous waste of time, but I don't care. It sort of goes back to the river hogs and the huckleberries and stuff like that. To me, if you're going to do it, copper might be a more interesting choice. Copper, I mean, we have kind of a checkered history with copper, but copper has a checkered history in the world. I mean, it connects to Bill's comments about Chile and Anaconda Copper. Anaconda Copper wound up buying American Brass in Waterbury. American Brass in 1909 used, I think, one-third of America's copper. We had a copper mine in Bristol. We had the famous copper mine up in Granby that then was also Newgate Prison. But the brass industry, the story of the brass industry in Waterbury, which was obviously, you know, hugely based on copper, is a pretty amazing story. It's not always a good story, and there's some Sherman antitrust violations and stuff like that. But to learn that story, to have kids in Connecticut learn that story, that'd be kind of cool.
I kind of like that story. Do you have a favorite element? I mean, copper, that's a pretty good one from college.
I mean, it's pretty good, but if we're going to choose, let's choose the mighty element and go with earth, wind, and fire instead. Whoa. We're going to get new casinos.
A classicist. I love that.
I love music.
I love that.
I'm all about music.
I only wish that we had some Earth, Wind, and Fire queued up for our outro music, which we don't. Bill, 30 seconds.
Well, first of all, I would like to make the state element brass. Now, on the one hand, brass isn't an element, okay? I can hear the criticisms already. But on the other hand, we're the nutmeg state, and that wasn't actually nutmeg either, okay? It had all those wood shavings in it.
That's true.
And so we do have this Waterbury history thing. And, of course, the only other possibility is uranium because things are just falling apart at such a steady way that it would symbolize all of our anxieties.
I like that.
And so I'd go with brass.
I'm still going with the yard goats. You can vote for yourself.
The
tweet
element?
Us at Where We Live. Bill Curry will be on later on our a very special Colin McEnroe Show Bracket Buster special. It's coming up at 1 o'clock.
Are an element?
Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, thanks so much. And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us here in the Wheelhouse on Where We Live.